Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As we practice during a period of retreat, we'll always come across difficulties and obstacles. And that's what they say is par for the course. We can expect those obstacles to come up. But it's important to know some of these obstacles so that we can not only anticipate them, but also sidestep them. The path to enlightenment is very well mapped out for us. It seems so clear, but very often that we make little progress and we don't gain those deep states of meditation, we don't gain the great insights which are based on those deep states of meditation. And we really want to find out why. As I've sat here and said before, it's not so much a fault of you. There is no one inside there. It's just a fault, as it were, of not understanding what the obstacles are, not really paying attention to the path, and mindfully recollecting that path throughout the day. And because of that, we can waste so much time. We can waste all of the retreat period. We can waste all of our lives. We can waste many lives thinking that we're practicing, when in fact we're not doing that which creates the causes for the path to emerge. So it's important to actually to know what the obstacles are. And of course those obstacles are the overly concern for this body, and that overly concern for the senses, overly concern for thinking. These are three major obstacles here, which I want to deal with first of all. The overly concerned for the body. Now, it's the concern about sleeping enough, eating enough, exercising enough, or whatever else it is that takes up so much time looking after this thing we call the body. It is part of the practice which I learnt under the forest teachers, to sometimes test this body, to go without sleep just to see what happens, or to go without food just to see what happens, or to eat food and see what happens, and to sleep to see what happens, and to find out exactly what this body can contribute to the practice of the path and how it can hinder the practice of the path. This body is a vehicle in this lifetime, and it can be used properly. This is its whole purpose of having a body, having a birth in the human realm, is to provide a means to practice and to realize the Dhamma. But only if we use this body properly. And to be able to use this body properly, we should always remember the middle way, and not to overindulge the body, nor to torture the body, to find out that middle way. And how can one really define that middle way? It's only just by the simile of the lute in the story of Sona, only when it's just tightened enough, not too much, not too little, so it makes a good sound. What does it mean by making a good sound? Only so that one can gain that peace, that inner happiness, that mindfulness, that wakefulness throughout the day, as long as possible. That sound which is not felt so much in the body, but so much more felt in the mind. A mind which is not so concerned with the demands of the body. If you ignore those demands too much, then those demands increase. If you indulge those demands, the demands increase. But if you find just that right balance, the demands of the body are not that much at all. But one has to be careful, because this body can demand even more than just comfort. This body can, seeking for comfort, can make all sorts of plans about how to improve your heart and how to improve the robes which cover this body. or with how to get new shoes for the feet, or with how to get a new chair, or how to get a new heater, or how to get a new whatever. And really, just what are all these external possessions and things really about? One should realize that the more things that one seeks for in the world, the more obstacles one is seeking for. I've just had the great misfortune to have a birthday, and people have loaded me with all these things, like cards and presents, and now I've got to find the next couple of days ways of giving these things away, ways of sort of getting rid of them, to try and empty my hut out. It seems the more I try to empty the hut out, the more things actually come into it, and I have to empty it out again, and then more things come in. That seems to be my life as a senior monk. But I can understand why, as a senior monk, that happens. But as a junior monk, as an Anagarika, just to see how empty one can make one's surrounding area. When I was a teacher, they said that you should develop this aura of authority. Like imagine sort of an area around you about 2 or 3 meters, and that's your authority area. So when any child comes in there, they feel that you're in charge and in control. That was how I was taught as a teacher. In the Dharma, you're taught to have this aura of emptiness around you, stretching even more than 2 meters. So whatever's outside you, you don't own. And if you do go into a crowded office, or a crowded kuti, or a crowded dana hall, or if you go into an alms round when there's all these people around you, especially when it's like a birthday celebration, to develop that aura of emptiness around you. All these things, they don't concern me, nothing to do with me, not mine, not me. And if you can develop that sense of emptiness around there, what you're doing is letting go of the stickiness of the material world. There's many ways of overcoming that stickiness of the material world, of overcoming concern of the body. You can, if you wish, to do the body contemplations. You can also do these other contemplations as well. In my life as a monk, I've found these other contemplations work. That's why I always teach these. By teaching such contemplations as like the emptiness perception, and doing such contemplations as not me, not mine perception, just the the concerns which are beyond this physical body of mine, other people's bodies, other people's things, your body, your things, your concerns. You can let go of these very easily. They're not mine. In the same way that you can disentangle yourself with this physical body. This physical body, it's so clear. I mean, for so many years that this is not mine. This is just a shell in which that which you call the mind lives for temporarily. And it's so easy. You've seen so many deaths, seen so many people getting sick. And you've seen the results of road accidents. And it's so clear that this has nothing to do with you. And so those sorts of contemplations, it gets rid of this concern for the physical body. That's the whole purpose of this, the concern for your own physical body, the concern for other physical bodies. So that you're not really concerned at all about attracting another body. In fact, you're not even concerned about this body. When you see the truth of bodies, it should give rise to nibbida. This nibbida is that the revulsion, the repulsion, the lack of concern, just as it were the same as, quite frankly, when it's like a birthday celebration, you go through with it reluctantly. Even like interviews, you do it reluctantly. Giving a talk, you do it reluctantly. You'd rather just be by yourself, alone in your hut. You're doing abbot business reluctantly. It's a duty. If I can't get out of it, then you have to do it, so make the most of it. This is all like using nibbida towards all these things. This nibbida can come through faith that this is the way taught by the Aryas, faith that this is what you read in the suttas, what we just chanted in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, that the person who sees things as they truly are, that all of these five khandhas, the five khandhas, the body and the mind, all of the senses, not just the sense objects, but that which experiences those sense objects, the sense bases, and the consciousness which comes up as a result of their coming together. But all of these things one feels nibbida towards, when one sees them as nothing to do with you, just like a thorn, like a boil, like a red hot iron which tortures you, just disturbing you. It's one of the things that you should be able to see, just even a little bit of samadhi. This great thing about the practice of samadhi, which is a great experiment which the scientist does, actually to prove these teachings as true. Samadhi, the way of letting go of these burdens and seeing what happens when they're not there. Seeing what happens when the sense bases start to disappear. See what happens when the khandhas start to disappear. This great experiment which actually proves the teachings of the Buddha for you as your own experience. But in particular teaches you that so this body has nothing to do with you. You can go through a super practice, but that won't fulfill the release of the mind from the body. It will weaken the attraction to the body. I've known many monks who have done a super practice for many years and met a woman, fallen in love, disrobed and got married. It's my experience. There's need to be more than that if you really wish to firm the commitment to monastic life and to reach the truth, which weakens the attachment to the body. But to fully get past that body, one has to know what is beyond the body. This is where jhanas provide the material, provide the experience which let you fully know, sort of, that this body has nothing to do with a self. Theory and faith can give you a great push along the way, but the insight, the wisdom, is what is necessary. Because when the body disappears, when it goes, when it explodes, when it fades away, however it disappears, and that's what happens, which eventually gives rise to the jhanas. The jhanas are stages where the mind has been released from the body. That's why the Buddha called them vimokas. Anyone who knows Pali will know that that's like the state of freedom, release, liberation, I think is the term which Bhikkhu Bodhi uses. And he's a very wonderful translator. And that liberation, liberation from what? It's not liberation from suffering yet. That's the experience of Magapala. It's a liberation from the body and the five senses. And when one sees that liberation from this body is possible, and what it's like, then one can overcome this great hindrance and obstacle of body. Which is one of the reasons why I and many other monks would teach all of this, whichever way we can, to try and urge, encourage, sometimes even to trick a person into getting samadhi, whichever way. So that one can see these experiences for oneself. One of the other obstacles which comes up, which I'm running ahead of myself, is the obstacle of thought. As every teacher says, these experiences which you have, you can describe them. You can describe them for hours, for years, write about them, describe them, but the actual experience itself, when you actually get there, will always be different. So all conjecture, all speculation, all argument about what is a jhana and what's at the other side is so much of a waste of time. The only thing you can do is inspire a person by descriptions. You can't tell them what it's like. You can give them some clues on how to get there, but everyone has to go inside that door themselves. And using a simile of Ajahn Chah, that you can not describe in words the sweetness of an apple. Not even a poet can do that. You just have to give a person an apple and say, bite. And let that experience show them the truth. And so much obstacle in monastic life comes from thinking too much, when it's not the right time yet to think. Having views, having arguments, having discussions about things which basically it's not the right time to discuss yet. Samadhi first, then comes wisdom. So the obstacle of the body is something which we need to overcome, and with that obstacle is the obstacle of the five senses, which you've heard me say before. These five senses are so intricately entwined in this body that you can say the body is the five senses. The five senses are the body. The two go together so strongly and powerfully. Which it might be one of the reasons why that there are different contemplations which lead to the same thing. You can be one who contemplates the senses, the six senses, the six sense bases. Or you can be one who contemplates the five khandhas. You can be have all these different paths which are coming to the same point of gaining samadhi. And then seeing things as they truly are. Throughout the teachings of the Buddha, and throughout the experiences of the Kubarajan, one finds a common thread of starting a process which, once it gets underway, is irreversible. And the meditator, when it gets to a certain point, is just the observer of this whole process which happens. And it's just getting to that point to start this process off. And you've heard that process from me so many times, you've read it in the book. You know, from piti comes pasadi, from pasadi comes sukha, from sukha comes samadhi, samadhi comes yathabhuta jnana dasana, yathabhuta jnana dasana comes nibbida, from nibbida viraga, from viraga nirodha. This is the way, from that vimutti. This is actually the way which is described. For those of you who don't know those Pali terms, you should do by now, I've mentioned them so often. Piti is this what's usually called rapture. Pasadi is the tranquility of body and mind, which leads to the inner happiness called sukha, which leads to samadhi, which means jhana, which leads to seeing things as they truly are, which means insight, which leads to nibbida, this repulsion, which leads to things disappearing, fading away. Which leads to the freedom, nirodha, nibbana. This is a path. It's a natural cause and effect process which happens. It's just getting to that point to start it off, and then it all just happens. And one is just a witness there. So by developing even just the contemplation of the senses, all this body, and that which sees the body, and which sees the other things in the world, and just to see just how that is just so uncertain and unpredictable. You can see one person one day think they're beautiful, see someone on the other day think they're ugly. You can hear someone teach one day think they're inspiring, hear them teach the next day think they're just a fool. You can hear praise, you can hear blame through the sense of sound. What is it? Just sound, that's all. And don't make a big thing about it. What do you expect with sound? Praise and blame come all the time, even with the Buddha. In my position, because I, as they say in the English language, you put your head on the chopping block when you stand up as a teacher and take responsibility. You're standing up here and say, hey, you guys, criticize me. You get praise, you get blame. And that's par for the course. Seeing that with Ajahn Chah, you read that about the Buddha, with all the Kubarajans, with everybody. And so how do you deal with that? It's just praise and blame, that's all. Just the sounds which you hear. Here in the Annatalakkhana Sutta, you just said that just all Vedana is impermanent. Whatever arises has these three types of Vedana. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's just the way of things. You can't have just pleasant without the others. What that actually does, it shows that this body, the pain and the pleasure, the pleasantness and the unpleasantness, what you agree with, what you disagree with, what's agreeable, what's disagreeable, to the sense of touch, to the sense of feeling, bodily feeling, to sound, to smell, to taste. That's all beyond your control. If you're born, you're going to hear many things you don't like. You're going to hear many things which inspire you. Please don't be excited by either. These are obstacles to you. The point is, in this path, we should not be just encouraging what we like to hear, or discouraging what we don't want to hear, but letting go of both. Letting go means disengaging, getting nibbida to what people say, getting nibbida to what you see, getting nibbida to what you feel with the body, with what you taste and what you smell. Five senses especially, getting nibbida towards those. So it means that whatever we hear, whatever we see, whatever we feel in the body, whatever we taste or smell, it never lingers. It never, as the words in the sutta say, it never invades the mind and remains. What it means is you don't carry around with you the experiences of the day. You don't even carry around, you know, what happened in the Dhamma hall back to your huts. You don't even carry it outside the door. All this five sense world, you see it as it truly is. And that gives the result of equivalent of body contemplation. That is body contemplation. Because it performs the same effect of abandoning this infatuation and concern with this body and five senses. It allows the mind to be released from this. And by doing that contemplation, what it realizes is that when one sits down to meditate, when one walks on the path or whatever, the mind inclines away from that world. You all know that in Buddhism, this the Tiloka, the three worlds, Karmaloka, Rupaloka and Arupaloka. Karmaloka is the world of bodies and five senses. It embraces the hell realms, the animal realms, Peta realms. It embraces the realms of human beings and animals. It embraces the realms of the devas. For most beings, that's all they know. For most beings, that's all they aspire to. Just to travel to the higher levels of Karmaloka. Never even knowing that this two more whole worlds. And why did the Buddha split these up in this way? Because Rupa Loka, the world of the jhanas, is just so different to the realm of the five senses. And Arupa Loka is different again. It is a different universe. Completely different types of consciousness. The experience is that different that there's this huge gap between these worlds. And so to get to those worlds is we have to leave behind everything we've known, everything we've understood, everything we thought about. That's why this thinking becomes an obstacle to our emergence from one world into another, to gaining the samadhi which can know those worlds. Not only the attachment to our body and to the five senses, but all these thoughts are thoughts which are intricately concerned with the body and with the five senses. If you just contemplate the thoughts, and just what are they thinking about? Even those which you conceive of as as Dhamma, a lot of those Dhammas are just worldly things. They're concerned with ideas, with thoughts, with names, which are really just part of this five sense world and body again. Even the language which we use is built up of the experiences of this world, of Karmaloka. And because we're not just attached to the world, but we're attached to that language as well, we can't move beyond that language. That's one of the reasons why we can't gain the passage into the jhanas. So often along the way, we're having a commentary. And we believe in that commentary. And we trust in that commentary. And that commentary just hasn't got the language to allow us to go deeper. It actually literally stops us. The words, the thoughts, the struggle for understanding of where we're at in these deeper stages of the meditation actually hinders us. That's why that I encourage the practice of meditation to be done without contemplation at the beginning and in the middle, and to leave all contemplation to the very end, the last few minutes, when one emerges from whatever state one has been in and is about to come out of the meditation, to spend those last few minutes like I was taught in science. Whenever one does an experiment, one does not make conclusions until all the data is in. Until you've got all the readings, you put all the dots on the graph. Don't extrapolate until all the dots are in. Because extrapolating with only half of the readings, what that actually does, you get this nice curve or a straight line, and all the other readings which don't fit in, you either discard as anomalies, or you fudge them. You bend the results to fit your theory. So much bad science happens that way, and so much bad practice happens that way. Fitting the experiences to the theory, rather than be willing to abandon all your theories. You do need to abandon so much. And that's why this practice of samadhi is just so powerful, because it requires you to abandon. It tests your willingness to abandon. It tests your skill in letting go. And no matter what one believes of, no matter what your standpoint, what your view, everyone should at least agree on this much, that the path includes jhanas. And the only reason why a person cannot get into a jhana is a defilement of the mind, is a craving, is an upadana, is not seeing clearly. It's an asava, it's a doing, it's a wrong view. So whatever is the reason, one knows that if one cannot get into jhanas, there must be a problem there. So the passage into jhanas is a test for you, a test of what's really true and what's really false, not through thinking, but through practice, what actually works. And so as we go through these practices, we can do body contemplation, we can do sense contemplation, we can contemplate the thoughts and to see that they are again just a more refined way of being attached to this world, because that's all the thoughts are. They're made up of language which is made up of old experiences of the five senses and the body. And it holds us down. So when we can contemplate these things and see them for what they are, we should be able to get nibbida towards those three things, towards the body, towards the five senses, and towards thought. If it truly is nibbida, as that whole process says, the next stage should be viraga. And viraga not just means dispassion. You couldn't call it dispassion, because whatever you lose passion for just disappears. If you lose passion for a particular type of food, you don't put it in your bowl anymore. If you lose passion for music, you don't listen to it anymore. If you lose your passion for the monastic life, you disrobe. Dispassion is another way of fading away, which is my preferred translation for that word. When you have dispassion towards the body, when you have dispassion towards the five senses, when you have dispassion towards thoughts, which is basically made up, they're almost like echoes, reverberations of the five senses and the body. When you have dispassion towards those things, they tend to disappear. The body spends more time being absent from your consciousness, so you can be with your meditation object. The five senses tend to disappear because you're not interested in them so much. You're not looking out so much. You're not listening so much. You're not smelling, tasting. You're not even feeling the body so much. Body can look after the body. Nose can look after the nose. Tongue can look after the tongue. Ear can look after the ear. Eyes can look after the eyes. Mind disengages. And as these things fade away, they fade away in ordinary life. It means one's concern for the things around you starts to dissipate. You're not so concerned with the buildings. You're not so concerned with whether you're in Australia or Thailand or New Zealand or whatever. That's just the world outside. That's part of the body. You're not concerned with other people, not even concerned with the other monks, unless it's your duty. So you're not having a fault-finding mind to all this world outside of you. Why have a fault-finding mind to other monks, to the food, to the huts, to the sky? Why have a fault-finding mind when that's got nothing to do with you? When you know that there are, just perception will see those faults. It's nature not to be right. This is dukkha. What do you expect? Fault-finding mind, just looking for the faults and things. You know there's faults there. You don't need to go looking for them. Because it's the faults means that you can never find perfection. You can never find permanent happiness in the world of the body, or in the world of the five senses, nor in the world of thought. So all that fault-finding mind, if I see someone and a fault comes up, I just abandon it. Got nibbida to all that. How long, remember in the early years as a monk, you went looking at other monks, and that's a bad monk, that does this, he's not right in that. After a while you get so much nibbida to all this critical thinking and critical talk about this monk and other monks. You get nibbida towards it, so it just fades away. Another monk, whatever he does or teaches, that's his business. Except that if they're my disciple, I just got to try my best. I do my duty. Whether they respond or not, that's their problem. I've done my duty. So just detach. Through that detachment, the things fade away. I always notice the more you go into the retreat period, the more you just disengage. The less of an abbot I become, just the more of a recluse I become the longer the retreat goes. And sometimes that when you sort of get into deep samadhi, you just basically, please excuse me, couldn't give a damn about the monastery, about the Buddhist society, about other monks. Everything disappears, fades away. And basically that's where you let go of the world of the five senses, the world of the body, all that world of thought around that. Things disappear. When you're watching the breath, everything else disappears. Breath meditation is easy. Why? Because there's nothing else disturbing you. Fed up with all of that. You're not thinking about the conversation which you had a few moments ago. You're not thinking about the food, especially when you're on retreat, what you got in your bowl, what you didn't get in your bowl. You're not thinking about the weather, you're not thinking about the pain, the earache or the toothache or any other ache. It's just body business. You're not thinking about the sounds, the heat, the cold. You're not thinking about the time, whether it's time to go to bed or time to get up. Just don't think about those things. That's all worldly business. So you just watch the breath, and these other concerns don't come and disturb you. And the thoughts about what you're supposed to be doing. Too many people have commentaries while they're meditating. What does this mean? What should I do next? What should I do? Should I do it this way? Should I do it that way? What did this teacher say? He's right. The other person's wrong. Blah, 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 blah. all those thoughts which go in the mind, just watch the breath. Keep it simple, dummy, as they say. Don't do it too much. Just watch the breath. And I can guarantee if that's all you do, just watch the breath and nothing else. Don't think, don't force. Just watch the breath in the moment, follow the instructions. And the breath becomes very still and very beautiful. It's the nature of these things. That beauty is like pity coming up, if you like, tranquility coming up, sukha coming up. It's starting the process. It's something which happens, that's all. Once you start getting into the beautiful breath, just leave it alone. Don't do anything. Don't go thinking. Don't go analyzing. Allow the process to happen. Press the letting go button. And if you can press that letting go button, you know where it is after a while, then the whole process just flows on. If it doesn't flow on, you're holding on to the doing button, the lever of control, the lever of me. Mine, my meditation, my ideas, my body, my thoughts, my senses. That's what stops you getting into jhana. Concern for karma loka, the world of the five senses, the world of the body, other people's body, the world of kutis, the world of letters, the world of sounds, the world of ideas. That's all that karma loka business. So, just watch the breath. Any of these obstacles come up, know them as obstacles. Know they're dangers. They stop you being released. Eventually, if you don't know the dangers now, when you've been a monk a long time, how much time do you waste on all this? How much time do you waste on this body? How much time do you waste on these five senses? Worrying and complaining about sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches. Being concerned with them, spending hours, days, lifetimes. Trying to get a nice taste, a nice touch. Trying to get to hear what you just really want to hear. All this striving for that world, where has it ever got you? Just completely abandon that world. See its danger. Remember, some of the dangers there can be very tricky. They're sort of con artists. They can dress themselves up as Dhamma. And you think that this is Dhamma, I should follow this, this is important. But be careful there, because that's Mara's last trick. Whatever comes up, if it's fault-finding, if it's not allowing you to let go, and it's not allowing you to be released, say, Mara, I know you. See if you can see through that. And if you can just say, Mara, I know you, if you really see it, then you just go back to the breath. End of problem. And allow the process to happen. When that process happens, and it's amazing that it will happen for each one of you sooner or later, and you find out that it was always there, possible, it's always you were holding it back. You were the problem. The me, the mind, the doer, the thinker, the controller, the arguer, the fault finder, the builder, whatever else it is you do. Stop it. And just one experience of that, and a bit of reflection afterwards, and actually seeing just why the process happens, why it is a natural process once you get out of the way, will give you not only the greater opportunity to go through that process again, but also give you huge insights. And these are insights which are based on experience, not just thoughts. So not just based on somebody else's Dhamma, what you read from other Kuba Rajans, or what you hear from me, or what you read in the suttas. It's just well known that when you hear a talk from someone else, you filter, you hear what you want to hear. What you don't want to hear, you just blocks off. Sometimes it doesn't even go to the consciousness. when you see what you don't want to see. You don't even recognize it, it doesn't register. That's why that old story at Ajahn Chah's funeral. And all the monks were, obviously one of the things they talked about was what Ajahn Chah taught. And every monk started arguing about what Ajahn Chah taught. And it was actually quite fascinating to see that. And it was actually Ajahn Jagwe who actually put his finger on the button, hit the nail on the head, when he said, yeah, just everyone has got their own Ajahn Chah. Now what you heard. And it's amazing, you could be listening to the same talk. You can read the same book. And you'd see two different Ajahn Chahs. You'd hear different things. That's what perception is like. And this is one of the beautiful things which I found out in the teachings of the Buddha. Vipalasas. Fantastic teachings. Shows that what you even sense has already been bent by the defilements. You don't hear what's there. You hear what you want to hear. You see what you want to see. You experience what you want to experience. Of all of the possibilities there, you actually seek out what conforms to your views, to your cravings, to your desires, to your predilections, to justify your views, your emotions. When I first saw that, that was just mind-blowing. And also just so frightening. How could you trust what you saw? How could you trust what you heard? How could you trust what you read? How could you trust what you taste, smelled? How can you trust what you felt in the body? Point was, you couldn't. Can't trust any of that. Even what you saw in the mind, what the mind thought, you couldn't even trust that. Because you couldn't see the hidden hand of defilements working. That's what delusion is. That's avijja, moha. Everyone thinks that they're right. Because you can't see the vipalasas working. That's why there's arguments in the world. It's called conceit. The only way past those vipalasas is actually through jhanas. It's only through the jhanas as a vipalasas which are based on the hindrances, on the defilements, on desire and ill will and views and all that. It's only when those things are temporarily overcome, when all desires, when all fears, when all views are temporarily gone, after jhanas. After jhanas, you've got no views. You've got no desires. You've got no ill will. You've got no fear. The power that which those states can, which give you fearlessness. I remember even my teacher, my Upajaya, Somdet Buddhajan. I was just talking to him once, and I was talking about meditation. And he told me that when he was a young monk, before he became sort of an administrator, so he practiced meditation in the south of Thailand. There was this one monk who was very famous in the area. This was maybe 50 years ago. He taught him meditation. He actually was sitting in a charnel ground, he was saying. And when he came out of his meditation, opened his eyes, he felt something cold on his lap. It was a big snake. And he said the amazing thing was that when he opened his eyes and he saw this snake and realizing it was very venomous, he never felt any fear at all. He felt just so peaceful. This is one of the results of samadhi, just fearlessness. And that fearlessness is not just towards wild animals. It's a fearlessness basically because you've given up concern for the body, and that lack of concern for the body remains for a long time. Lack of concern for other people's bodies. Because of that fearlessness there and the lack of desire, that's the opportunity where you can see what you don't want to see. where you can experience what you never expected to experience, where the denial mechanisms of the mind are not working, where all the defilements are temporarily subdued. There you have a chance to see. There you have a chance to look beyond. It's at that point where wisdom arises. Not through thinking, not through speculating, not even through listening or through reading. Those things just help get you to that point. Once one is there, then one has an opportunity to have a clear look, clear of the hindrances, clear of the defilements, clear of the whipalasas. You have a chance to have a look at what this body and mind is, what these sense bases are, what the sense activities are, what this doer is, what consciousness is, what mind is. It's only at that point, just the quietness, the clarity, the power which is there after jhanas, that's where all these arguments end. That's where all of the insights arise. That's where freedom comes from. And the point is that those people who are free, there's a sense of release and lightness for them. No matter what they say, it's just their freedom, the lack of craving, the lack of ill will, the lack of problems. People want to find a meaning of this life. They want to find a way out of suffering from this life. They want to have an ending to death. And we're always looking for people who can guide us on the way. So the result of actually seeing the Dhamma is the release of the mind, the release of the body, the release of everything, the letting go, the liberation. So please test out the monks you know, the teachers you know. Test them out to see if there is that release there. If you see the monk getting angry, if you see the monk having craving, it doesn't matter what their reputation is. It doesn't matter if they say they're enlightened or they say they're this or say they're that. Enlightened monks or nuns do not get angry. Dosa is a defilement. They have no craving. So test out. Test yourself out as well. Have a bit of humility as well. If one hasn't got to the jhanas yet, and don't think one knows. Keep all these opinions, ideas on the back burner. And just leave them there and see what happens when you get to the state beyond jhanas. So this is what one needs to do in this practice, to avoid the obstacles. This is not a place for debating. It's not a place for filling the mind up with too much knowledge. Just have sufficient knowledge of what to do. So the path is very clear, it is the Eightfold Path, and it culminates in samadhi, in jhanas, which leads to the ninth and the tenth factors of the path in the Anguttara, samavimutti, pure right liberation, freedom, and samavimutti jnana, the knowledge that it's liberated. The two, as it were, last factors of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold is a path. The ninth and tenth are the results. So please actually follow this path. Make samadhi in this monastery the main thing. Whatever else you do in this monastery, see if it is supportive of samadhi. If it is supportive of samadhi, follow it. If it is hindering it, then leave it alone for a while. And so that the samadhi can grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Find out what the obstacles are. Why it is that the path doesn't happen. What are you doing there? What are you lingering on? And if it is on the body, if it is on the five senses, if it is on the thoughts, just contemplate those in whichever way you wish. But contemplate those for the whole purpose of freeing the mind from those things, freeing all concern from those things. And know that your contemplation, your practice is working by how these things don't bother you so much. When these things stop bothering you, then the path towards jhanas is clear. So please liberate yourself from these obstacles. And may you all attain jhana in this retreat. You all have the ability to do so, so stop messing around. And see if you can get the jhanas and the liberations which come from it. So don't linger on this side of jhanas. Something to be done, please do it. Thanks for the talk for this evening. Is there any questions? Okay.
Sangha Namah.